So I have accidentally created another mini-series on this podcast of different episodes on the history of our beloved plants. We recently had Jane Perrone on for a fabulous episode on the history of houseplants last month, followed by the recent episode that I hope you loved on the history of war or victory gardens with Maggie Stuckey. And today, we get to dive into the history of probably the most celebrated aspect of the plant kingdom, flowers. As you'll learn in today's episode, the human race has been obsessed with flowers since basically the beginning of time. And Noel Kingsbury, today's guest and celebrated garden writer, has the most impressive vault of knowledge of the history and the interesting symbolism of so many flowers across so many generations and cultures. And guess what? The common thread is we all love to grow flowers. So get ready to find a deeper connection and understanding of the favorite flowers you're growing in your garden today.
Welcome to the Growing Joy podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives. I'm Maria, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, an epic plant killer turned happy plant lady. On Growing Joy, you'll find conversations about plant care, plant community, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy, the podcast.
Hello, plant friends. Welcome back to Growing Joy. I'm Maria, your host. If you're new, welcome home. We're growing plants and we're growing joy. That's what we do over here on the podcast. I have had a beautifully planty week. I hope you have too. Spring has sprung and it just feels so good for the sun to be out and to walk around with no coat after being under snow for 8 months. I live in the woods in the Catskills and man, it's been a long winter and I'm so excited to be in growing season again. Also, share this episode with someone you know who loves flowers. This episode is so interesting. I'm so excited to have connected with Noel Kingsbury, the author of The Story of Flowers, which is an epic book, which would make for an amazing table talk book. It's so gorgeous. It's beautifully illustrated. Every single flower, it's 100 flowers, and every single flower has the most gorgeous illustration. It dives so deep on these flowers' histories. I really have enjoyed learning about them. I loved chatting with Noel. Love his British accent. Love a foreign guest always on this podcast. And yeah, learning about the history of these plants in this accidental miniseries, like I mentioned, just has made me feel more connected to them. And it's been really cool. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Here's Noel. Noel, welcome to Growing Joy.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. I've spent delicious moments of my morning every day this week for a couple of weeks, just having your beautiful book on my coffee table and flipping through the different beautiful illustrations and reading. It's been such a nice part of my morning routine. Congratulations on a gorgeous book.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to get into. Do you know Jane Perrone? She's an English writer.
As it happened, I was interviewing her on Thursday night.
You were interviewing her?
Yeah. We do a weekly public service broadcast for our Garden Masterclass programming, and it all goes out on YouTube. And I was interviewing on Thursday night about her new book, Lessons of the Leaf. She's great. Legends of the Leaf, that's it. No, she's great. I mean, she's just really, really knowledgeable and a fantastic communicator. And it's a really nice book. And I'm not a great one for looking at garden books, quite honestly, because most of them are just recycling the same old stuff. But there's a lot of really genuine research and great stories there. And yeah, that it's one of the best garden books I've seen for ages.
Oh my God, I need to send her just a video of you saying that. She's a friend of mine. You know, we were the first two podcasters about houseplants. So we've kind of come up together. We also both came out with books around the same time. She came on my show. But, you know, it's funny. We had her do an episode on the history of houseplants on my podcast. And I felt like as I was reading your book, there are so many similarities with the detail of research, the intense, niche focus of yours, flowers, hers, houseplants. So I feel like all of a sudden we're giving my listeners history lessons once a month with houseplants and now flowers. So tell me, Noel, how did you become the plant person that you are now or the plants man that you are now? When did your passion for plants and flowers begin?
I always gardened as a kid and carried on through teenage years, the usual teenage cacti and stuff. Had a few friends at school who were interested in gardening. 2 years running, probably when I was about maybe 16, 17, two of us skived off sport on a Tuesday afternoon to go to the Chelsea Flower Show. And yeah, had a bit of a break during university years, but then got back into it via allotment gardening. And then sort of late 20s, I suppose, I decided to try my hand at running a small specialist nursery. which was a good way in.
Wow. Did you get a degree in horticulture, or you just figured it out as you went?
No, I've got a degree in politics. I've always been interested in plants. I learned on the job. I mean, I think there are some very real advantages to doing that. I mean, you don't necessarily get all the received wisdom. And I suppose an awful lot of basic horticulture had been so much a part of my life because my father was a great gardener and I'd always been around plants and spades and earth and wildflowers and what have you. And yeah, I've just basically, like a lot of people in the British nursery business, I learned as I went along.
And your nursery business turned into kind of a public speaking. You're more of a personality now than a grower.
Yeah. I mean, what took off was, this was the late 1980s, early 1990s. Garden design was just beginning to take off. I did a certain amount of garden design. Then I wrote an article for The Garden, which is then the Journal of the Royal Horticultural Society. And then wrote a couple of other things for them. And then, and this is absolutely unthinkable these days, but I had two letters, you know, old-fashioned letters before email, one from the Garden's editor of Country Life and the other from a now defunct magazine called The Gardener, inviting me to write for them because they'd seen my stuff in the garden. It was just the case of being the right person, the right place at the right time, you know, before the kind of mad rush for the door of garden media, which happened really in the sort of later 1990s, happened. And so, you know, I was kind of well placed really to follow up. It's writing which really took off for me.
Yeah. You've talked about kind of plants weaving their way through your life. Do you have like an early memory of what plant kind of drew you and maybe an early childhood memory of plants that you felt really connected to?
A very early memory, probably the earliest one really, is I must have been about three. The scent of my father's heather garden. There was a fashion then, at least if you were on the right soil, of growing a whole lot of heathers together. And of course, when you're small, you're quite near the heather. And the smell, I remember it really strongly. And it's not when, as an adult, you are aware of smelling so much because you're that much higher above the heather. But so the smell of the heather and somehow the sort of funny kind of rustly texture of it as well. So that's probably my earliest plant memory.
Yeah, smell is an interesting one. I feel like when I was doing research for my book, realizing how little smell or how often overlooked smell is for a gardener's experience of their garden, you know, but it's actually the most profound connection to our brain, which I've loved. What on earth, this book, reading it, felt like, even just as I was reading it, it made me think the amount of research that must have gone in to writing this book. How long did it take you and what on earth gave you the idea to write it?
Well, it's something I've been working on. I mean, this is not the only publication I've done in this area. And so it's been an ongoing project. I mean, I'm taking a break from it now because I've got so much other stuff to do, but it's been quite an ongoing business. It's not easy. I mean, I think the problem is that although we can now find out quite a bit about the wild habitat of plants, and there's an awful lot of material, increasingly material online, the history of plants and cultivation is actually a very difficult one to research. Information tends to be extremely scattered and very often not indexed. I mean, I used to spend quite a lot of time in the Royal Horticultural Society Library in London, which used to be an amazingly easy place to access. I mean, much less so now. The RHS made it a lot more difficult, but it used to be somewhere where I could just go and every time I went to London, I'd spend some time there. And it can be at times extremely frustrating. And what tends to happen is you store away little nuggets, kind of sometimes sort of almost plant trivia, especially if they are something you know you can go back to. There's a very, very good German book, which was extraordinarily well, and whoever researched that must have taken an enormous amount of many years, I think. And it obviously concentrates very much on German-speaking countries. But that was an enormously helpful source. I was also very lucky in my RHS library days, I came across an extraordinary book published in 1997, a Japanese book that was written in English, although Jinglish would be a better description, a very odd English, which I've since been able to buy secondhand. And that is an extraordinary insight into what is actually a very closed off culture. And that's just an absolute mine of information. The Japanese influence on what we grow is actually very big indeed, which is generally not realized. And this book, which is really one of the most beautiful things I own, it was a fantastic source. Other than that, obviously, web searches, just kind of odd following following up. And, you know, sometimes I'll be in a library somewhere and I'll be able to make use of that. But it's not a straightforward path by any means.
Yeah, it requires, I would assume it requires a certain amount of passion to have the follow through to actually execute it, because it's not low hanging fruit. I was surprised at how much discussion about cultivation was in the book. In, you know, the book really was the history of cultivation. For listeners who might not understand the lengths that people go through, how many of the flowers that we buy have been cultivated, can you kind of give a high level definition of cultivation and how it started and how it's evolved throughout the different centuries?
I think, you know, cultivation we see as essentially when you deliberately plant something and make some effort to look after it. And in terms of food plants, that probably goes back, you know, several thousand years BC. I mean, we have a fairly good records of the cultivation of cereals and peas and lentils, etc., in the Middle East. And we're pretty sure that a lot of other cultures were growing stuff for food. In terms of growing plants simply for the pleasure of the flowers, it's difficult to know. I mean, almost certainly very much later, but the evidence is always going to be extremely thin. So we are then very much dependent on written, really on, we know, only know for certain once we have really written sources, really sort of Han Dynasty China. There's obviously a lot of biblical references to flowers. How many of them were actually grown, of course, we've really got no way of knowing. The, whichever queen it was in Egypt who sent a plant hunting expedition to Punt in what is now the Republic of Somaliland is probably the first documentation we have. But I mean, that was more for economic botany than flowers.
But it's interesting how plants have truly played a role in culture, in society, since the beginning of society. You know, we think, I think especially post-pandemic, so many people think that they've just found plants and that plants are this new thing. And oh my gosh. And it's like, no, we've been connected to plants since we came on Earth, you know? Let's see. It was amazing the wide range of civilizations you discuss. Can you talk about the similarities and differences that you noticed in the different civilizations you've talked about?
It varies an awful lot. I mean, one of the, yeah, that in the West, we have grown, when the Greeks and Romans grew plants and flowers for ornamental reasons, something they probably got off Persia. I mean, Persia was probably the original source of the Western, inverted commas, garden tradition. In the Far East, really China, I mean, Tang Dynasty China, which is sort of more or less corresponds with our Dark Ages, so pre-Norman conquest kind of time, was a very sophisticated culture. And that was when we know for certain that things like camellia and peony were, it was certainly not the first time they were cultivated, but it was the first time that we have textual evidence about lots of there being lots of varieties and people growing them in temple courtyards and people actually making a fuss of them. And also, I think this is probably the beginning of the idea of looking at landscape as something aesthetic and something to write and philosophize about. And the Chinese were probably in a good 1,000 years ahead of us in that respect. India is an odd one. I mean, Hindu temple art is full of flower symbolism. Sanskrit poetry is full of flower symbolism. But classical Indian civilization, which of course was, you know, an extraordinarily advanced civilization on many levels, never seemed to be particularly interested in gardening. There is really not much of a Hindu tradition of gardening, which makes gardening in today's Narendra Modi's, you know, deeply intolerant Hindu nationalist India a problematic one, because the gardens are either British heritage or their Islamic heritage, and therefore, you know, politically unacceptable. I mean, the Far Eastern tradition, I think, has enormous cultural depth. I mean, Japan, because of the sort of lucky presence of this book, I've been able to research. I would dearly love to have some more contact with researchers in China, which has such a long history, and of course, such a long history of recording everything. So one day, perhaps, we'll have greater access to the Chinese material. I think there are many, many similarities really between once flowers and plants get into a culture, you tend to see similar sort of developments happening. You have high culture flowers and, you know, low culture flowers, and you have, there's always often a sort of competitive element and an element that's kind of seeking out the weird and wonderful.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on the high culture versus low culture? I noticed you indicating that with some of the different plant profiles.
Okay. Great recent example. The dahlia. My dad was a miner's son. He was a working class Welshman. And that was a culture which was You know, very strong on gardening and traditional British working class culture had a strong culture, and dahlias were one of the things that were, they were easy to grow. They were really showy. They were kind of exotic, and he grew dahlias. And I remember when I was first had my nursery business and I was very much aware of what was going on in the garden world, which would have been the 1980s. You did not grow dahlias. You know, if you RHS Flower Show, that whole London upper middle class world that rather dominates gardening, you did not grow dahlias. What was in, what was cool was pink flowers and silver foliage. There was a whole thing about silver and grey foliage and pink.
So what makes dahlia, what makes it lowbrow?
English snobbery. You know, never underestimate the force of British snobbery. Yeah, because it was a working class flower, because people like my dad grew it, you know, it was not cool to grow it down the King's Road.
And is it a cost thing?
Dahlias are cheap. Then along came Christopher Lloyd. Now, Christopher Lloyd was the garden writer for Country Life, you know, the upper class house comic, fantastic writer, you know, silver spoon in his mouth, of course. He inherited this fantastic half-timbered pile down in Sussex, where his mother had made a garden, and he carried on gardening, and he was always somebody who was like to break the trend. You know, he almost deliberately courted being unfashionable. And so one day he decided to rip up his mother's rose garden and plant it with exotics instead, including dahlias. And he started using dahlias in the border. I mean, they're a fantastic point of strong colour in late season and a really good way of sort of pulling out other colours from perennials or other plants around. And of course, he wrote about it as soon as Christopher did anything, he'd write about it in Country Life. And so this was kind of shock, 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 not only pulling up this heritage rose garden, but also planting this rather sort of low class flower. And what was really funny was that the dahlia that really broke ranks with the sort of upper class garden snobs was the Bishop of Llandaff. Llandaff is a rather obscure diocese in South Wales. Why the Bishop of Llandaff had this fantastic red dahlia named after him, I don't know. But this became the cool dahlia to grow. And then various other dahlias followed. And then, of course, people like Sarah Raven, who have a sort of very, very effective, if perhaps rather overpriced, retail business selling to well-heeled gardeners. You know, she makes a fantastic selection of dahlias and everyone now grows them.
We are in wedding and housewarming season, plant friends, and I cannot think of a better, more thoughtful, more magical gift than a personalized Wind River wind chime. Wind River chimes will deliver the most magical, most thoughtful, and personalized gift straight to your door. Wind River Chimes creates premium, handcrafted, and hand-tuned wind chimes, which are designed for exceptional precision and lasting beauty. For over 35 years, Wind River Chimes has been passionately pursuing harmony by delivering wind chimes that help create a peaceful, soothing, and restful environment. We have had two of their chimes on either side of our house for the last 4 months, and I have to tell you, plant friends, waking up to the sound of the chimes from my bedroom window singing to me has honestly made my house feel like a spa. I love the wind chime that's outside of my office. It sings in the wind throughout the day, and it's a reminder to just drop in and be present. I'm obsessed. And I bet whoever you gift one to would be obsessed as well. A Wind River chime is the perfect gift because every time the recipient hears the gorgeous chime singing in the wind, they're going to think of you and be gifted a moment of calm. Plus, if you use the code GROWINGJOY at checkout, you'll get a free engraving on any engravable wind chime. So you can personalize the wind chime with a name, an anniversary date, or a special message. Go listen to all the different options they have on their website. Head to windriverchimes.com to listen to all of the melodious options and use the code GROWINGJOY at windriverchimes.com for a free engraving to add a special element to your gift. Once again, that's windriverchimes.com with code GROWINGJOY. All right, plant friends, it's gardening season. It's go time. And if you're gardening in any capacity, whether it's outdoors or indoors, you got to look to Espoma Organic for all of your potting mix, planting soil, and fertilizer needs. If you don't already know, Espoma Organic is a long-term partner of the Growing Joy podcast. They're a 90-year-old family-owned and operated company dedicating to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. And as you're tending to your gardens this year, they've got everything you need to keep your plants happy and healthy.
If you're planting things up, you can use their potting mix or their garden soil that's suited for whatever your setup is, whether you're container gardening, whether you're raised bed gardening, whether you're in-ground gardening. They've got the mix and the compost that you need. And then as you're continuing to feed your garden, you can use their line of tones, which is their line of fertilizers, which are specifically created for different aspects of your garden. So they have a flower tone, they have a bulb tone, they have a garden tone. The different tones are created for the different types of plants that you're growing in your garden. I particularly love their tomato tone. I use it in all the grow bags that I grow tomatoes in. It's super easy to use. You just sprinkle it on top of your soil and water it in so you can go check out all the different tones that they have to offer. And if you're a houseplant parent, just keep it simple with their general potting mix, their general succulent and cacti mix, and then you can use their liquid indoor houseplant fertilizer to feed your plants throughout the growing season. It's so easy. It's liquid. It comes, the cap pre-measures the liquid. So you literally just pour the liquid in the cap, dump the cap in your watering can, and poof, you're fertilizing your plants with no like crazy math involved. I love working with Zespoma. They're good people. The company is run by a wonderful family. And to top it all off, they have a huge sustainability commitment. With 100% solar powered plant, zero waste manufacturing, and eco-friendly packaging, to learn more about their indoor and outdoor products, visit Espoma.com to see where your local Espoma dealers are. Or you can click the link in the show notes to go to my curated Amazon storefront with a list of all of my favorite Espoma products. Once again, Espoma Organic. What about an example of a higher class flower? I guess orchids, right?
Well, the orchid is an interesting one that's gone the other way, because orchids used to be, the growing of orchids was part of the, it was almost essential for a certain level of Victorian high society to grow orchids. The whole culture of the buttonhole, men would wear a, you know, top hat and a buttonhole, and orchids, many orchids are ideal for buttonholes. Orchid growing in the 19th century, it was an extraordinary social and cultural phenomenon. And it was very much about an exclusive upper class, well, aristocratic layer of society. And of course, they were expensive and they were not necessarily, I mean, it's difficult to kill an orchid, but it's also difficult to grow them well. Then, of course, you have the Phalaenopsis revolution, which I suppose started in the 1980s, 1990s. You know, Phalaenopsis orchids, which come from a climate zone, which is one that's very comfortable for us anyway, bred very much for tolerating our homes in terms of temperature and humidity and light. And then a whole international production system set up. They're propagated in one country, grown onto a certain size in another, air freighted somewhere else, usually to Holland, where they're then grown to the size you'll then see them in the shops. And we haven't actually got any, but we have had. And Phalaenopsis orchids now are everywhere. They have made orchid growing finally democratic. You know, you can pick them up for 10 euros.
Oh my God, you can get them for $4 in the grocery store here.
Okay, I'm out of ammo. Yeah, probably. Yes, everything.
Yeah, it's crazy how affordable they are. And reading about the history of them and how inaccessible they are. Is it also this whole different class thing with flowers? Is it also a greenhouse, a high maintenance thing? Because you mentioned Victorian, the Victorians were the ones that had these like ornate greenhouses attached to their homes and stuff. So is it what you can keep in a greenhouse versus what you can have in your home? I remember you in your begonia chapter, you talked about how everybody could have a begonia in their home. No, sorry, not begonia, geranium, pelargonium.
Yeah. I mean, if it's something that the classic pelargonium is an extremely robust plant. It's difficult to kill. You know, everyone can grow it, minimum winter protection. Whereas if something needs a greenhouse and really good ventilation for some of the year and warmth the rest, it's expensive stuff. And that was part of the orchid as status symbol. It was not just about the orchid. It was also about being able to afford the greenhouse, the coal, the labor to look after them. It was a whole kind of package that must have been interesting to kind of price that out in modern currency. And what a greenhouse of orchids for a respectable Victorian industrialist on the make would have cost. I mean, it probably is possibly equivalent to kind of having one of those posh boats down in Monaco or somewhere.
Yeah, like a second home almost. It's so interesting. It reminds me now, you know, in the houseplant community where my podcast is rooted, everybody gets the fancy watering cans and misters and grow lights and indoor greenhouse setups. It's almost similar. What about symbolism? You know, an interesting thing that I also garnered from reading your book is flowers had so much symbolism across all cultures, all decades, all, so, you know, civilizations. I thought the iris was interesting because it had such symbolism in so many different cultures. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, the iris, I think, stood out because it's such an interesting shape, and the Japanese picked up on it, and in the West, it became the fleur-de-lis. And flowers have, yes, symbolisms, which are sometimes kind of obvious and other times anything but. The rose, of course, has a massive amount of symbolism in both the Christian and Muslim worlds, much less so in the Far East. I mean, although there's a big part of the rose's genetic heritage comes from China, you know, it was not an important plant for the Chinese. And things go off in funny, almost kind of random directions, like chrysanthemums became associated in Japan, of course, became associated, so sort of similar time to our Middle Ages, with the imperial family. And therefore, that gave chrysanthemums enormous status. They were also the key plants that flowered as the weather began to cool down in the autumn. Brought over to the West, the fact that they were autumn flowers kind of led on to a bit of an association with them being used in funerals and therefore became a symbolism of death. And apparently in Italy, if you give someone a bunch of chrysanthemums, well, you only do that if you're the mafia, because apparently it means you're wishing them dead. And I remember going to visit some friends for lunch in Portugal, and we wanted to buy them some flowers, and the range of flowers was limited to chrysanthemums. So we sort of cautiously went in with these chrysanthemums and said, "We've got some chrysanthemums. Is it okay to give them to you?" "Oh, yeah, 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 that's okay." So, but we just had to make sure. The Xantodesia Aethiopica, the white arum lily, is, I think, one of the strangest in that it's something that, you know, it's a very unusual flower, and it flowers, you know, our Northern Hemisphere Easter. For some reason, that got associated with death and became used at funerals. You know, my father would have nothing to do with them because for him, they were the flowers of death. But of course, flowering at Easter, they became associated with the 1916 Easter Rising in the Republic of Ireland. And so, you know, the Easter lily has become in the six counties in the north is really powerful symbol of Irish republicanism, you know, with the Armalite rifle, the beret, the tricolour on the coffin, all of that incredible symbolism of Irish republicanism. And it has this white flower, and it's on the masthead of Ann Poblacht, the Irish Republican Army's newspaper. So I'm sure for Northern Irish loyalists, it's probably, you know, it's absolute, don't bring Easter lilies anywhere near us.
Yeah, it's so interesting how the same little innocent flower can have such different meanings around the world. I'm curious, why do you think people are so attracted to flowers in general? Why do you think people see themselves in flowers and that they do have this rich, long-standing connection with the human race?
That's an interesting one. There was a book written by an anthropologist some time ago with a chapter headed, "Why Are There No Flowers in Africa?" African cultures have generally avoided flowers. Part of the reason may be to do with the fact that over much of Africa, at least those parts of Africa that had more advanced civilizations, which basically means Western Africa, you know, civilizations like Benin and Mali, there were not actually that many flowers that you would grow in a garden. They were sort of treetop flowers. There wasn't that much material, but it's an odd one. Other than that, the color, the fact that they're transients, the fact they don't last very long, I think is a big part of the fascination. The Japanese, of course, have taken that to a very high level with this whole cherry blossom thing. The 10-day flowering of the cherry blossom is about symbolizing transience, and the beauty of transience is something that's very, very deep in Japanese culture. And they've always been, in a way, rather mysterious. I mean, we, at least in the West, did not realize that flowers were about sex and reproduction until extraordinarily late in the day. It was a German naturalist, Camerarius, who in the 16th century finally wrote that, that flowers are the way plants reproduce. And people didn't realize that until then. So they would have seemed perhaps almost like a gift of God to decorate the earth for our joy. It would be interesting to speculate on what, you know, the medieval Christian mind made of flowers. I suspect, I don't know, I mean, the Islamic world, the Chinese world, I have no idea quite when they realized that the flowers were about reproduction. But yeah, I would say basically it's the color and the transience.
You have a great line in your book. You're quoting someone that says, you know, when you're giving someone a bouquet of flowers, you're literally giving them a bouquet of sex organs. I was like, wow, that's interesting.
Oh, yes. Dear old Roberto Bulli Marx. Yes, always a good one for a quote. Yes, yes.
Yes, I was like, wow, I never thought about it that way. I read somewhere that humans might be intrinsically attracted to flowers because they symbolize the fruit that they grow into. So, you know, on some biological level, we see a flower and we think, oh, that's going to turn into a tomato or an apple or some sort of source of food. Have you ever read that?
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, it sounds sort of reasonably logical, at least with a, you know, apple blossom or something that's going to turn into, you know, is going to turn into something you can eat. I suspect it varies across cultures for, you know, different flowers.
I was super curious to learn about the co-evolution of flowers and pollinators. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. Flowers have to be pollinated. If you're wind pollinated or water pollinated, you just produce vast amounts of pollen and sort of chuck it to the wind. Otherwise, you've got to find something that will carry the pollen to other flowers of the same species. So it's always been in the interests of plants to evolve relationships with animals, generally insects. The very first flowers, which were sort of basically Jurassic Cretaceous era, dinosaur era, were fairly sort of big chunky things, magnolias. I mean, magnolias are amongst the most primitive flowers. They were around before there were bees. So it's thought the beetles were pollinating magnolias. And then once you get an insect that evolves to feed on flowers or a particular flower, then the flower will then tend to, there will be evolutionary pressure towards designing flowers that were particularly designed around that particular insect. So you then get this kind of instep, like a step lock, where one evolutionary step favors the evolution of the other. They're then in lockstep. I mean, some of the orchids are quite extraordinary. These very, very long nectaries, which only moths with a particularly long tongue can access. But by attracting that moth, they can be, you know, 99.9% sure that they will get pollinated. So it's a kind of like a lockstep relationship. So I think it's increasingly being researched. I mean, so it is, I agree, a really fascinating one.
Well, yeah. And the thought that now, are they co-evolving with us now that cultivation is so popular and almost standardized? Like, are they smart enough? You know, you kind of alluded to that.
That's an interesting, yeah. I mean, essentially, plant breeding is a form of evolution. And you could argue that the most successful plants are those that are in that kind of lockstep with us. I mean, I previously did a book on essentially crop breeding and looking at things like maize and wheat and rice and yeah, maize, which has this incredible ability to respond to fertilizer. You know, you're sort of people of what is now Mexico thousands of years ago discovering that, you know, you could just, if you want to chuck on loads of manure around a maize plant, you get a maize plant that's twice as big. That was something that meant the maize plant was then in kind of lockstep with us on this evolutionary ladder.
Yeah, it's so interesting. What flower surprised you the most in your research? Or I guess, what history was the most surprising to you? What fact was the most surprising for you to learn?
I think my favorite story with the whole book, actually, which I think links in with this final question about dahlias, if I could deal with the dahlia here. I mean, dahlias were, you know, almost certainly grown by the Aztecs. I mean, Aztec, or what is now Mexico, Central American flower culture, almost certainly was very advanced. It's just that we have so little record of it because of the impact of the Spanish conquest. But given how much variation was shown in dahlias when they were first introduced, seems to indicate that the Aztecs must have done some breeding. Now, they arrived in Europe from Habsburg, Spain, in the 17th and 18th century, and very, very rapidly took off. And they were spread, first of all, through the domains that were linked through the Habsburg monarchy to Spain. And so they ended up in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where they, I mean, it's a sort of a relatively warm climate plant, but because it dies back in the winter, it's very easy then to dig them up and store them inside. And so dahlias are probably the easiest way you can bring really exotic color to a garden in a continental climate with only primitive greenhouses. And it's just absolutely fascinating to discover that during the latter years of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, when you had all these different national groups beginning to assert themselves as nations against the Austrians and Hungarians who ruled the show, dahlias became a sort of cover for Czech nationalism. And there was this lady, Božena Němcová, who was a leading supporter of the Czech language and Czech nationalism. And so the growing of dahlias became a kind of cover. People were genuinely interested in growing dahlias, and you can see fantastic dahlias today in the Czech Republic, but this was actually a cover for nationalist activity to sort of hide their activities from the secret police. And she was known as the Dahlia Queen, and there was the Dahlia Ball, whereas in fact it was all a cover for a Czech nationalist agitation.
Dang. It's so interesting.
A lot more colorful than the Easter lily, it has to be said.
Yeah, a lot more colorful. Yeah, I grew dahlias for the first time last year, and they were just the star of my garden. It was so fun cutting them, gifting them to people. It's so interesting. I'd love to just spend a couple of minutes, you know, speaking of gardening, where this episode is getting released in the height of gardening season. I'd love to just touch upon a couple of plants that probably a lot of listeners have in their garden. And maybe you could give a little tidbit, a little fun fact about each of the flowers so people can walk away with their intrigued, because you have, is it 50 or 100 flowers?
There's 100 in the book.
100 flowers, each with the most gorgeous illustrations. Your illustrator is wildly talented. What about peonies?
The peony was the flower of choice for the Chinese elite for most of Chinese history. Peonies symbolize wealth, good fortune. They flower for a really very short time, but they're very long-lived plants. And so the Chinese elite would have grown, were growing them from really very early days.
Yeah, they're a lesson in patience too, because they don't flower for, once you plant it, they don't flower for the first couple of years, right?
That's right. That's right. They take quite a while to settle down.
You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutri-Greens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutri-Greens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results. Yeah. And on the polar opposite side of the scale, one of my favorite flowers to grow, the zinnia, it's like, it's popping and growing for you almost immediately. What about the zinnia?
Well, yeah, zinnias, like dahlias, they come from Mexico and Central America. Again, this whole crazy color range. And some of the best varieties today are bred by a company called Benary, a German company who were based in what became East Germany, a company of a very, very interesting company who have played a really major role in production of many flowers. But today I think it's their zinnias that are definitely tops.
That's amazing. I know you wrote a whole book on this flower, but I'm still enjoying my daffodils right now. I know that's a special flower to your heart, right?
Yeah. I mean, daffodils are incredible survivors. They will go on potentially, you know, for hundreds of years because the bulbs just endlessly kind of clone themselves. And this is very much, I mean, the genetic center of origin is very much Spain, Portugal, and the Maghreb in North Africa. But they are very adaptable to temperate climates. And for me, they're very much a flower of the west of the British Isles, Wales, Cornwall, the West Country, the areas where I've lived most of my life. And they're also the flower that was sort of taken by British colonists all over the world. They'll grow in other climates, but they're a I'm actually now living in Portugal, and I found that we're having a very dry spring, and a sort of climate change spring, and this very worryingly dry spring. But I was extremely interested to see that the daffodils have coped far better than the tulips or the Dutch irises, much better than the classic Mediterranean plants. And that's because I think they have this long growing season. They root in early, which is one reason for them being so robust.
Oh, I love that. What brought you to Portugal?
Wife's daughter decided to emigrate here so that kids could grow up with European passports. So we're Brexigees.
I love it. Wow. Very cool. I've heard Portugal is incredible. Okay. The poppy, the opium poppy. That's also a very interesting history where a lot of us are growing poppies in our garden.
Yeah. And poppies are, a lot of them, most of them are annuals. There are some that are very much true perennials, but no, opium poppies in particular, yeah, there's some really crazy cultivars and very, very sort of big ones with enormous numbers of petals. And they're very easy to grow. I mean, they kind of almost grow themselves. Once you've had them 1 year, the seeds pop up in future years. And of course, the opium poppy has always been grown for medicinal and, of course, illegal drug use as well. So it's very much a flower of a double-edged sword in a way, a beautiful flower, but one that has a lot of very clearly very problematic associations. And I suspect that in some American states, it's probably illegal to grow them, but it certainly isn't anywhere in Europe.
Yeah. I'd love to ask you one more and then we can wrap up. I recently just polled my audience on social media about how they're feeling. And a lot of the response was, I'm feeling burned out. I'm going through a season of struggle. And I was reading your piece on the lotus and that phrase, no mud, no lotus, I think is so important. I think we can all learn a lot from the lotus. And I think symbolically too, it's obviously its story and its growing methods have kind of shown itself in the symbolism. Can you speak a little bit to the lotus and why maybe we all should embody it?
Well, the lotus, the first year I have ever grown lotuses. And they are extraordinary flowers. I mean, I was saying earlier about the magnolia being a very primitive flower. The lotus is as well. This is something that would have been probably more or less unchanged since dinosaur days. Diplodocus probably would have paddled amongst lotuses. And so I bought some. They're terribly expensive, about 30 euros a root from a German nursery. And it's always a bit of a worry getting things one end of Europe to the other. But anyway, they arrive and we've potted them up in some soil, and they're sitting at the bottom of a bucket at the moment, growing their leaves. Once you get them going, they are pretty easy to grow, I think, so long as they're kept frost-free in the winter. I think they're extraordinarily beautiful flowers and quite unlike anything else. That very strange structure in the middle and the fact and the, all the Buddhist and Hindu symbolism. And also, I think you can eat more or less any part of the plant. So it's a plant, I think, with a huge amount of symbolism. And I think its beauty is a very, very, you know, geologically ancient one.
Yeah. No, that's so weird to think about the dinosaurs swimming next to the lotus. I have to ask you, I'm sure you hate being asked this question. Do you have a favorite flower, especially after swimming through all of this interesting information?
I think, yeah, I decided a while ago that I would always give the same answer here. And that's Cyclamen cuum, which is one of those little hardy cyclamen which flower incredibly early. They're wonderful alongside snowdrops. I love the kind of dumpy shape of the flowers and the fact that they're so sort of brave in the elements, facing the elements at that time of year. And you know, the foliage is really attractive and they come in every colour from pure white through to kind of screaming magenta. Yeah, that time of year in January, especially in Northern Europe.
They were much more popular as houseplants in the 70s, and I feel like they're really not celebrated as houseplants anymore.
No, well, those are the big pot ones, which is derived from another species. I mean, that's always kind of gone in and out of fashion. But the one I'm talking about is the one you would only grow out in the garden, and they're quite small, they're only like this big. They grow under, people grow them under trees alongside snowdrops, and they're, you know, totally bone hardy. And one of those things that there's a huge amount of natural variation within that species, and you know, no amount of breeding could ever really do anything to them. I mean, nature's provided all the good genes that's necessary.
I love that. I love that resiliency that inspires you. Well, this book is so good. Where can everyone find this book, your other books, more information about you? Let us know all the call to actions.
All good bookstores or what your favorite online source for books. I mentioned earlier about I do a weekly public service broadcast with my business partner, Annie Guilfoyle, called Thursday Garden Chat for Garden Masterclass. We're an online garden and landscape education portal, and we love talking about plants and flowers.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was so nice chatting with you.
Thanks. Gillette worked out well.
Thank you so much, Noel. This was such a fun conversation. He is so knowledgeable. I mean, obviously decades of being in the garden will do that to you. But if you're looking for a good planty coffee table book, this is a great option. Like I said, it's beautifully illustrated and it's just lovely. I learned so much. I really enjoyed reading it. I actually am thinking about giving it to a friend who loves flowers. So thank you very much, Noel. Check out The Story of Flowers. That's the name of the book. Thank you so much to my listeners who joined the Growing Joy Garden Society this week. I love you. I can't wait to get to know you in the platform. Like I said, it's the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. You can access it via Android or iOS app or your computer. It's a beautiful way to connect with our international group of listeners of plant friends to propagate your planty knowledge and also to support the show. Subscribing to the platform helps me support my podcast manager and editors and the amazing team of plant ladies that keep this show running on a weekly basis. All right. The sun is shining. I gotta go get outside. I gotta go listen to my bird song outside. So I'm gonna hop. I hope you spend time with plants today. I hope on The Story of Flowers, I hope you learned something about one of your favorite flowers that you're growing this year and that you can go spend some time admiring your blooms in your gardens. Until next time, sweet plant friends, keep blooming and keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure that you're subscribed to the show so you don't miss an episode. We have incredible episodes lined up in 2023, and I don't want you to miss one topic. And while you're subscribing, would you mind clicking over to the review section and leaving us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so I thank you in advance for helping this podcast reach as many planty earbuds as possible across the globe. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got a ton of free options for you. First, there's the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's so fun. It takes literally 3 minutes to complete. You take the test, you get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you, inspired by your results. The link is in the show notes. Make sure to let me know what your personality is after you take the test.
If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, check out my website. We've got a bunch of free guides that you can download on topics like understanding natural light, which is actually a 3-day worksheet, and 9 ways to green up your office if you need to bring a little bit of planty joy into your work life. And finally, I want to invite you to join the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet, my online garden society. It's both a web platform and an iOS and Android app. It allows our listeners to get together in an algorithm and troll-free online space to swap plant care tips, humble brag about plant wins, and get support when you have plant fails. We have monthly live planty show and tells on Zoom, which are so fun, and even have a living library of planty book recommendations sourced from our community. You can go to jointhegardensociety.com to grab your membership. And for anything else, plant friend, I am here for you. Feel free to drop me a line, whether you have an idea for an episode, an event, or maybe you're even a planty business interested in sponsoring the show. And of course, following me on Instagram and TikTok for daily planty silliness, musings, and tips is always recommended. You can find me across socials at Growing Joy with Maria. Thank you again so much for listening. It is truly my honor and life's delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy, the podcast.
Make new plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group. So if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.